Welcome to episode 8 of the Vader Podcast Studio Confessions. With me today, I have a very, very old friend and an incredible drummer who's played with a great deal of many different artists over the years, including Amen, Alec Empire, Beat Union, Lost Prophets, No Devotion, and currently here with me in the UK for this weekend's download with Low Lives. Can I have a very nice welcome for Mr. Luke Johnson?
Thank you for having me.
It's nice. Well, I forced you in here, really.
You didn't. Honestly, I've been trying to get in here for a long time.
Have you?
Yes. I mean, I think in our history, I've only missed Vader 1. I recorded in Vader 2.
Yep.
I recorded in Vader 3.
Mm-hmm.
I missed Vader 4, but I visited.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't yet recorded in Vader 5.
But you have spent 2 days rehearsing.
But I've spent 2 days rehearsing, and now I'm on a mission to record in Vader 5.
Well, exactly. I'd like you to come and record in Vader 5. And I think the Low Lives album should be done here.
Oh, I'd love that. I think it should be done here too.
Yeah.
And that's not the album that we just did. We're talking about another album. We're going to get on it.
Well, the new album's amazing. I've got to congratulate you on that because I love it. Both George and I have been listening to that all week.
Thanks.
And I cannot wait to see it live on Saturday.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mission to get that out. So I'm glad you like it. And I'm glad it's finally out. We've been sitting on it for a while.
How long did it take you to make that record?
Well, it kind of came about. We were ready to make a record. It's kind of like that saying, right? Like, don't get ready, stay ready. Lee shits out songs. We're allowed to swear on this podcast, right?
You wouldn't be on it if we couldn't.
Lee shits out so many riffs. That's why I call him Riff Lord. The Dropbox is like bursting. And so, you know, every now and then when I get time between being a parent working for a drum company and all the other shit that I do on the side. Actually, that being a parent is definitely not on the side. That's probably the main gig. So let's just rephrase that. When I get some time in my studio at home, I'll go through his large Dropbox of riffs and triage out some of the best riffs and then start trying to, like, you know, formulate them into songs or whatever. So we were in that situation where we'd done an album's worth of songs. And album number one doesn't exist. Technically, the album that just came out is actually album number two. We had album number one done. We recorded that with Bo in 2018. Yeah, 2018, we did the album with Bo. And we were shopping around trying to get, like, you know, see if any labels are interested. We had a few bites and started having conversations. Those conversations last months, as you know.
Mm.
And we dropped a single and done an EP, pressed the vinyl. So it was a limited 1,000 pressing of the vinyl. And as we sort of like came to the end of life of like the vinyl, we still have the vinyls, which means we didn't fucking sell much if it was 1,000. But, you know, as that kind of came to end of life, because we did all that ourselves, DIY, you know, we were like, part of those songs would make the rest of the record. So we did the record, shopped around, waited an incredibly long time to end conversations or reach their kind of finalization. And we didn't have a deal. And then boom, we're in a pandemic. And so it was kind of like, fuck, well, we were going to self-release a record. One of my mates was just like, man, I think you guys really need to break that up. He said, more bites at the apple. Fucking burned into my brain, that is. And so we did that. We broke the whole album up that we were really proud of and just put out two songs every sort of 4 to 5 months through the pandemic. Mm. And honestly, it kept us afloat. And so that was originally album one. And the album that you have on vinyl, or the one that you're listening to, is actually album number two, but it's our debut album. So, and it's funny because people online have like asked for us for an album for a long time. And so, you know, we've been like, oh, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And here we are, we've been a band 7 years. We just put out our debut record. But interestingly, Adrian Bushby's manager, Adrian produced the record, you know Adrian very well, had reached out to us when we were in our stay ready phase, not ready to record an album. And basically, we thought it was a bullshit blag email. Ben, his manager, emailed us. I represent Adrian Bushby, and he loves your band. And we were like, is this like Grammy Adrian Bushby. And so we Googled and we're like, fucking hell, that's big chips. And so we were kind of like, how does he know about our band? Turns out he'd heard I Don't Like You on the Radio 1 Rock Show. Dan was playing it quite a bit. And I wrote him back and I said, all right, yeah, that's very interesting. Let's, you know, have a chat. And so he set up a chat, had a great chat with Aid, felt like we were on the same page. So I started giving him access to the Dropbox, select songs. Mm. Like, you know, I think we put 20 in there and said, what do you think makes an album out of these 20? Like pick, I think we said initially pick 10. And then we ended up with 12, two B-sides. And so he picked what he felt would make sense cohesively as a record, which is not something we'd normally do. Mm. But when you're working, when you're a tiny band with no financing and you do everything out of your own pocket, and then Grammy Lord knocks on the door, you're kind of like, well, he knows what he's fucking doing, doesn't he? So we were just like, Aid, pick a Grammy-worthy album, mate. And sprinkle a bit of Grammy juice on it. So yeah, and honestly, this all came about in the pandemic. So this would have been 2022. So we started the conversation at the end of 21. And we were like, how can we record an album in the middle of a pandemic, right? People can't travel. and we just managed to select a window in the UK that by chance lined up with when they went down on the threat level. Yeah, I don't know if you remember the threat level. Yeah. Like the threat level went down, so he didn't have to quarantine at the airport for 2 weeks anymore, which would have just destroyed us. You quarantine in place. So residential studio, we're going here. And so we basically didn't leave the studio for the entire time except to mail in the day 2 and day 8 COVID tests that you have to mail. And they would call us every day and check, where are you? Have you left the premises? And so, yeah, we just managed to pigeonhole it in there.
Was that an American government thing?
No, it was the UK. Oh, okay. UK government, yeah. And so we did that. We got in there and we all stayed in. We did end up doing it in chapel. Remember, we had a conversation about trying to do it here and whatever. And so we ended up doing it in chapel. Aid did us a killer deal. It was literally one of the most fantastic experiences because we're in this kind of like post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah, right.
But the Euros were on. And, you know, obviously, like, we're getting to know Aid in the studio, and Aid's quite a character. So we just, you know, we'd eat dinner together like a family. It was like working all day and all night, and just, you know, there was no boundaries to sort of like when we would end. And we'd got done so quick with the, I think we did, so it was 10 songs. We got done so quick with the 10 songs that we said, let's do another two. Did like a handshake deal, same as what we did with the other ones. And then we did another two songs, got them done so quick. And we still had like, I think 3 days left in the studio. So we were like, fuck it. Should we just like video a live session with any cameras that we've got? And I have a couple of GoPros. Everyone obviously had their iPhone. Aid had a couple of like little cameras. We've nabbed a dash cam out of his car. Like, there was anything that we could plug in that would film video with an SD card slot or like go to a hard drive. We were like, we just capture all these, and as long as it's in landscape. And so I did that. I think I did a 7-camera shoot, and we just did a super like budget kind of Audi version of Live from the Basement. So we did 5-song live session with all these cameras, and we were just like, this will be fun. So that was kind of how it ended up. We wrapped it up there, and it was awesome.
I think that's probably the best use of studio time I've ever heard.
It was funny. I remember he was like, I've got a fucking dash cam, I'll get it out of the car. And I was like, fucking a dash cam, all right. I was like, if it's got an SD card slot, we'll make it work. And I remember setting the dash cam up, gaff taping it to a mic stand. And yeah, it all worked out. And I've got that footage. I was like, I'm fucking not editing this. One day someone's going to want to edit this, I hope.
Amazing. So,
yeah.
So I mean, you've had a quite an unusual introduction to the music business because you were like born into it because your father was a manager of the Wonder Stuff at the time. Yeah. So you were, right as a kid, you were around it. So not talking about the first, in fact, yeah, this question has two aspects of it. Like for your first time in a recording studio, so the first time ever, so I'm hoping you were wearing nappies, do you know what I mean? And then the first time you actually went into a studio to record. Yeah.
So it's a bit foggy the first time ever, but I do remember in Starbridge, in Lye,
right?
The Stuffies had a place that they, it was either their rehearsal room or it was a place that they would rehearse at regularly. And I remember going there with my dad, and obviously, like, thinking back now, which is quite crazy because my brain's going, your first exposure to everything, you think that's how it is, right? So growing up as a kid, right? Whatever your parents say is how it is like, oh, that's how the world is, right? Yeah. You don't have too much perspective. So I remember going to this place in Lye, and it smelt like beer and like moldy carpet and cigarettes, and there was loads of gear and flight cases, right? And that smell, right, has stuck with me my whole life. Yeah. Some studios and rehearsal rooms still smell like it to this day, but you walk in there and there's a very distinct smell of like studio band rehearsal, like just greasy rock and rollers.
Do you remember the old Vader used to smell of that?
It did a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it.
It did.
Yeah.
Yes, it did. And I remember that, right? And I don't remember I remember entering a room. There was a room that you would walk through that was like a roller shutter, and it was gear. So it was like storage gear. So there was loads of gear in there. And I just remember being overwhelmed by gear and stank. And then there was like the rehearsal room for the other side. But the first time I remember like really entering a studio, not yet to record, but like in my mind, being like, oh, this is a place where the music is recorded, was when my dad had Adam doing some demos at Workshop in Redditch, right? And it was always very distinctive because I remember the blue and black logo, right? It was kind of like paint splatter.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
That's always burnt into my brain.
On the wall on the right-hand side.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then there was the big blue box around the stairs that led down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was tucked under the ground in Millsborough House in Redditch. And I just remember like local chatter about that studio was like Brian May's recorded there, Manic Street Preachers are recorded there. Like, so you're just like, oh, that's some, like, I'm going in a place where like famous people have been, you know, and going down the stairs in there. And I remember they were in there recording, and I don't know if you remember Workshop One.
Well, that's the first, when I first started working with Dave.
Yeah.
Because my dad took me down there to go and meet Dave. We were going to go do our first demo. And I remember, I was a massive Wonder Stuff fan at the time, like, you know, huge.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting down there and Dave had made my dad and I a coffee. I must have been about 15. He's like, oh, would you like a coffee? And we sat there with coffee. And I just remember glancing over to the, do you remember on the left-hand side, there was that shelf with all the Ampex 452s?
Yes, yeah.
And there was this one, and it just said, the Wonder Stuff, who wants to be a the disco king?
Yeah.
And I remember just like getting like almost anxiety and excitement. It's like, oh my God. You know, and that was it. The studio was sold to me at that point. Yeah. I was like, I wonder if Miles sat here.
It was a TAC Matrix, or was it Scorpion first? He either had a TAC,
Scorpion.
Scorpion. So Scorpion was the first one, TAC Scorpion, and he had a TAC Matrix.
When he went upstairs, to the top room,
And that studio had the same smell.
It did.
I remember, right?
Yeah.
Because it was like, in those days, unless you're balling out of control, you just basically put some shit and then carpet on the wall. The high traffic carpet.
Yeah.
So it was all high traffic carpet on the walls, right? And then there was like the parkans in the live room that he had over the little drum riser.
Yeah.
But it's funny because like I'd been in there and I'd had this experience and I was like, just blown away, right? And so that I was very young then. And then when I was in high school, like I would frequently go and pop in there, you know, or I'd see Dave Morris around Redditch Town Centre and just be like, it's fucking Dave Morris, God rest his soul. You know, I was like coming up to my teenage years in high school, and they're like, I think it's the second year of high school, they make you go and get work experience.
Yeah.
Find a work experience placement. So everyone's applying to like Redditch Bus Centre. Or like fucking, you know, I don't think Primark was around then, but like Argos, I'll go do work experience in Argos or the fruit store, you know. And I was just kind of like, they were like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to go in a studio. And they're like, there's no studios. And I was like, man, there's the one of the best studios in the world. And I didn't know that. It's the only studio I knew, right? But like in my mind, it was one of the best studios in the world. And so I had my dad take me up there so I could ask Dave. And do you remember Mark?
Mark Tempest.
Yeah. Mark used to kind of intimidate me a bit. He didn't intimidate me. I was intimidated by him.
Because
he had, like, you know, he's always a spliff in his mouth. He was very kind of like stonery, and he had that beard, and he was just like, he had the big earrings. And I was always just like, he's super cool, but he, like, you know, but he was a lovely dude. And so I went up there and I asked him and Mark, and Dave was like, I'm good if, you know, if Mark's good, come in for 2 weeks. And, you know, whatever we've got in, you can just work with us on it. I obviously didn't touch a desk. didn't touch any musical equipment. I literally touched the kettle and the cups and the sugar bowl. And I was just constantly on, obviously, tea duty, which is like, you know, it's almost like a joke because it's kind of like, that's two on the nose, the tea boy. But I did. I tea boyed for 2 weeks. And it was awesome. And honestly, I think it was a little bit later on and dance music had started coming around. And so he had some really horrible dance shit in. And he's obviously doing it to make the money and keep the studio open, right? Like, it wasn't always Manic Street Preachers or Brian May in there. Or the Wonder Stuff, for that matter. And he basically, he had this terrible dance song in, and I remember thinking, I bet this will go to number one. It's like terrible. I remember the chorus this day. In fact, I'm not going to say the chorus, just on the off chance that somebody that made that song is listening, and I'd hate to offend them, but it was a terrible dance song. And the last thing I'll say about Dave, actually, is and me and you would always do this in all of our Vaders, right? Because you have a great impersonation of Dave, which I think you should be doing on this podcast. But it was in the phase where I think we were first recording with you, and we realized, like, because Dave Morris recommended us to you because he'd wrapped the studio up and started doing Talon, right? He was doing live sound engineering. And that's how we got connected with you, because Dave had said, you know, I know this great guy, Matt, and you should go record with Matt. And we'll get onto that studio in a sec. But the thing that he used to do when he would lock in with your snare, and it's unfortunate because this is not a visual podcast, but he would make this kind of like wide arch, right?
We're both doing that.
Imagine taking a drumstick. I'll try and describe it for any listeners. Imagine taking a drumstick, pointing it at the roof, and then making it go up directly, pointing at the roof, and then come back down, pointing directly with the tip of the snare. Not in any way that you would ever hit a drum.
No.
Like stabbing the roof and then stabbing the snare.
Yeah.
And he would do it in time with the, you know, the beat. And I was always kind of like, that's a very interesting technique he's got there. But it was his kind of like little, you know, is his little moniker.
Was he the first producer you worked with?
Yeah. So when I was, funny story actually, when I was 16 or 17, so I think I did 14 or 15, I think I did the work experience placement. Then when I was 16 or 17, I wanted to record, right? Now, Miles from The Wonder Stuff had given me a Tascam 244, right? That was the only way that I'd ever recorded. And I had two, I think it was Tandy Realistic microphones.
Smart.
I had two Tandy Realistic microphones that were hardwired. And they were jack end, so they weren't even XLR, like 3/4 inch jack or whatever. And so I would plug them into the Tascam and I'd hang them over the drum kit and just get basically record a bunch of cymbals. I'd never done a proper recording, but like we'd like roughly demoed out microphone in the room at band practice with this band that I was in at the time. And my dad was like, do you want to go in the studio? I'll see if I can get you a day. And I was like, all right, that's crazy that you can get us a day in the studio. I mean, it's unfathomable at like 15, 16 to go pay for a day in the studio. And he had, so with the Wonder Stuff, there was somebody he worked with in publishing and he said, my son's got a band. He said, I'll send you the demo. You can have first dibs. He said, get me £350 to pay for a day in the studio. And he was like, I'll sort you out. And so Sony BMG or something like that paid, I don't remember who it was. I think it was Sony. He squeezed out of somebody at Sony the first demo that I ever recorded, which in hindsight, I haven't thought about that actually since having been stimulated by this
Your
conversation.
First demo pretty was paid for by Sony.
Yeah. I mean, they did not give a shit. I'm sure it was petty cash and like, don't give us the demo. You know, but
that's the advantage of having Les Johnson as your dad.
And so we went in to Dave's and he said, yeah, I'll do you a day for £350 and then I'll mix it afterwards. And we went in there and recorded 5 songs in such a way that songs don't really get recorded anymore. It was fully live. So like we're doing full takes as a band, you know, and we just, he recorded us live. And I remember it to this day, actually, because I had my big Gretsch kit that I was playing that was way too big for me to be playing. It was a 24 kick drum, 14, 16, 18. So, and I'm like 16, you know, it's like, but yeah, I've still got that demo as well. And I remember getting the CD the burn CD of the songs and just thinking like, whoa, I've got like a fucking CD of songs that like can be played on a CD player. And everyone in the band got one, and that was it. There was only four copies. We didn't like try and sell it at a gig. We didn't like, we didn't do anything with it except for consume it for ourselves.
Yeah,
it
was
like in hindsight, I've never thought about that either apart from now. I just like, we didn't actually try and sell anything.
Stick it on Spotify now.
Mate, do you remember on Deluxe Paint, the paint thing on like old PCs
where
I made the front cover on Deluxe Paint, printed it off my dad's, printed four, folded it and stuck it inside the burnable CD, and that was it. There's only four copies in existence.
That's amazing.
And a couple of tapes. Yeah, so it's pretty nuts.
So like, we started working together
98.
It was about 98, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was Shoot McGavin. Or was it Shortcut to Newark?
Shoot McGavin was the first one. So
then we did Shortcut to Newark.
I wasn't in Shortcut to Newark when you did Shortcut to Newark.
It was Dean's brother, wasn't it? Yeah.
Carl was in Shortcut to Newark.
Yeah. And then we did Harpies together.
No, so it was Shortcut to Newark was the first recording.
Uh-huh.
So we did two songs, Coming Home and Pentimento, and it got boss tunage.
Yeah, yeah.
Put out a split 7-inch, two songs each side with a band called Dugong from Leeds. Fucking loved that band. So it was fucking nuts that we did a, that was my first ever release, like on a vinyl, 7-inch vinyl, yeah. That was my first ever release, and we did a split 7-inch. And then off the back of that, because it was on Boss Tunage, that's how we got on Lee Aramez's radar, and we got three shows with Snuff. And I was like, I'm going on fucking tour. There's three shows. I'm going on fucking tour. And so, yeah, so it was Shortcut to Newark. We did that. And then I got asked to join Harpies. And so I was doing both those bands at the same time. And basically the long and short of it was, and maybe if you ever talk to Dave, he'll recount this differently, but at the time I didn't smoke weed and I'd just passed my driving test. So I wasn't really drinking alcohol, right? And the other two lads, we were a three piece for anyone that doesn't know that band. In fact, you all don't know that band, anyone listening, but we're a three piece band that played basically punk music.
The Elvis Costello top lines.
Yeah, Elvis Costello top lines. And then, you know, there was a lot of weed getting smoked. And so there was a lot of things that just weren't, like, I always saw myself as wanting to go the whole way. But I also affiliated with a very punk rock crowd. So to me, like, I always wanted to sign a big record deal and it to be my life. And a lot of the people I kind of rolled with at the time wanted to just release 7-inches and be punk and cool. And I don't think I was ever like cool. I was just kind of like taking it like, this is my career.
Mm.
And a lot of people were like taking it as cool. And so that band ended because of that primarily, like not in a bad way, just as in like, I think we all want different things. Like you go do your things, I'll do mine. So Harpies was the complete opposite. It was a metal band that was getting played on radio, and we
time I ever heard my work played on Radio 1.
Yeah, Marianne Hobbs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Radio 1 rock show back in the day. We in fact, actually, because we'd recorded with you and you knew Jay, he was working at
Jay Greenwood.
Yeah, and Jay started coming to the shows and watching, and we were getting the radio play and stuff, and so we did that. And then after that, that's when I went and played with Little Hell.
Oh, yeah.
Which we did that tour with Placebo. That was my first proper tour.
Yeah.
That was 2000, I think, or 2001. So went on tour with Little Hell, opening for Placebo on the... I was going to say the Ghosts Inside, Sleeping With Ghosts
tour.
I love that album. Banging record.
Apart from the fact that it's like so top endy.
Yes.
It has to have been mixed on a massive coke binge.
Fucking table skiing all day long.
Yeah.
That's a big moment for me doing the first tour. And as a young man, I was very obsessed with Placebo as well.
Great
and
band.
Then that led me to going into Amen, and then after Amen was when I joined Shortcut to Newark, that then turned into Beat Union. You'd already done the album with Shortcut at that time.
Yeah.
Although Shooter McGavin did do one more, we did do one more 7-inch. We did two tracks for you the first time I came to Vader. Then we did two more tracks. Then I did Harpies. Mm. So the second two tracks also were released by Bus Tunage, but the budget was a little bit lower. So it was actually a photocopied cover, whereas the first one was a nice like slip, you know, cover. But yeah.
So like I remember around that time when I think it was around the Harpies time.
Yeah.
That you started getting really into the recording process in two ways. A, you wanted to know what was going on. You wanted to know how snares were, what were we doing to EQ that snare?
Yeah.
I remember you wanting to play with the desk.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you became very sort of inward looking at your drum performance. It's very rare actually, especially as young as you were then, that drummers notice there is a huge divide between playing in the studio and playing live. And obviously you're a monster live. I mean, you fucking kill cymbals. You have immense power. And, you know, as you were saying earlier on, like, you know, when you used to play with other bands, every other drummer in all the other bands were terrified of you using their kit.
I can't afford to play drums anymore because the amount of shit.
Mate, like, you know, you're an absolute monster, but you worked that out quite quickly and you went into this like, oh, okay, I want my kit to sound like this in the studio. I need to play it differently.
Yeah.
And I remember that sort of, that hitting you and you sort of really detailing your performance and your technique in the studio. But then that around that time you started getting into the recording. So is it, or were you always fascinated by the recording part of it?
So firstly, I remember being really into snare sounds. We actually talked about this earlier on.
We had many arguments over it.
We did. And I also, my young late teens, early 20s, unrefined self.
Fiery, did not
know how to express myself or communicate properly.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah, I've learned a lot better in my older age. So, you know, sorry about that. but no, I was, I don't know if you recall, when I left high school, I'd had that, you know, workshop experience and my grades weren't amazing at school. And so I went and did like a media course at Redditch College and I didn't like it because I didn't want to get into film and video, but it was the closest thing I could get to like audio at the time. I was kind of like trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. And Robert Plant had that funded course at Kidderminster College. So it was a BTEC National Diploma in Audio Production Technology. And this was at Kidderminster College. It was run by Kevin Gammon, who was in Priory O'Brien, funded by Robert Plant. And John Bates was the recording audio production. And then Gary, I don't remember his last name, but he worked on two of Bjork's records. Mm-hmm. And so it was like pretty insane lineup of people to create this course. And you had to have some pretty good stuff to get on the course. And so I went and did that media course to retake some of my GCSEs and get something else under my belt so I could be a bit more appealing to apply for the course. And so I applied on the course. And that was really the first time I was exposed properly to like desks and computers, like, because, you know, when I worked for Dave Morris and Mark Tempest, I was a T-boy. I didn't touch any desks. I just got to look at the logo, you know, watch the VUs going. But that was the first time I'd get my hands on a desk at college. And they had an old Mac G3 with Logic 4 on it or something like that. And, you know, a couple of little bits of outboard. So I'd started showing an interest then because I'd started learning about the process of recording and studio etiquette and things like that. And then I think that kind of parlayed into recording with you. I'd also started to figure out like what my music taste was. I'd been exposed to things that I hadn't been exposed. So growing up, I was like exposed to what my dad was working on. Like, you know, so it was a lot of indie music and a lot of great stuff like New Order, Joy Division, The Cure, you know, obviously The Wonder Stuff, Ned's Atomic Dustbin, Populate Itself, Eat, all of the bands that we love growing up on, right? Like the Farm, Charlatans, all of that stuff. And then all of a sudden along came Smashing Pumpkins, right? And so that changed everything. That changed my life. I can't like under explain how hard and of a definitive moment that was when I was 13 and I found Gish in the CD rack, right? And heard I Am One for the first time. Beat changed my life. And interesting side note for any Smashing Pumpkins nerds, I just watched the Rick Beato interview with Jimmy Chamberlain and I just found out that for basically 35 years of my life, maybe a bit less than that actually, so let's say 30 years of my life, I've been playing I Am One wrong. Yeah, he does a play of the beat on that, and I was like, wow. So yeah, like that parlayed into like Americana and like that kind of stuff. So like grunge music and 90s stuff, and I got really into that. And then as I started going through college, it was like the nu metal phase, right? And I remember being on the, before I got to Kidderminster College, somebody played me Fear Factory for the first time, and I was like, what the fuck is this? This is like some hard ass shit, you know what I mean? And then I got into Machine Head, and then like I started to get into like more metal stuff. So I'd gone from like indie kind of jangly sounding guitars, right, and like hooky choruses and kind of baggy sounds, to like grunge, like, you know, gritty guitars, to then just straight down tuned like fucking meat. Like, how is he doing that with the bass drum? Oh, a double pedal. How does he make his feet? Like, you know, if you ever listen to, I don't know if you ever listened to Burn My Eyes by Machine Head, their first record, Chris Kontos on that record. I'd never heard drumming like that in my entire life. I was like, how the fuck is he doing that? So that kind of parlayed into heavy music. And by the time I was coming into the studio of Vader with Harpies, we were basically like, make this sound like the Terry Date snare and kick drum, like Deftones kick, yeah. Like fucking.
Everybody wanted that at that time.
Man, it was like, it was so special. Like, I listened to that. I listened to Around the Fern now, right? Like, I got into Around the Fern first, and then I found out there was an album before that later, right? So Adrenaline came later for me. But listening to Around the Fern, even today, right, songs of that will come on in the background, and it's almost like I'm immediately teleported back to those late teens, early 20s, like where I was at college and like just working a shitty little side job, trying to get gigs and playing in metal bands and stuff. And it's nuts how like that music was so transformative for me, you know what I mean?
But you fell in love with tones as well as records.
I did fall in love with tones.
Was that
tones.
The whole like thing, the drug that took you into the recording thing of enjoying recording?
I think it was like more just that once I'd learned how to record, I'd seen behind the curtain a little bit. Right, so like, think about that experience where my dad was able to get Dave Morris to do us a £350 day in the studio, paid for, right? Like, that to me was the barrier to entry to get in the studio. Like, money was a big barrier to entry to get in the studio. Otherwise, it's Tascam 244, and that sounds like shit with the Tandy Realistics, right? So that then, like, now it's like, oh, fucking, there's a studio at college that I can record in any time. And then the hunger came to be like, well, I don't just want to record me, right? Like, you could book the studio out and do extracurricular activities afterwards, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if the studio is available, you could book it out. You get 2 or 3 hours in a night and you'd be like, where's a band that I can record? Like, so then you would be like detached from the creative side of making the music and trying to track it, right? You would just then trying to capture what this person is putting down, right? Like what they're trying to emote on their music and the feelings they're trying to get out. And so, and everything I recorded was horrific. And we were still on, so it was a mixture actually. We still had the ADAT, the Alesis ADATs there. So everybody, when you joined the course, had to buy 2 ADATs and bring them in, right? So we all had 2 ADATs.
Super VHS.
Yeah, yeah. So we all had the ADATs in our backpacks every day, right? And you could, you know, and then you could sometimes get time on the G3, right? And so it's kind of like this little bit of a hodgepodge, right? So you know, it's a crapshoot what you're going to get. Like, am I going to be able to book the studio and get the G3, or am I going to have to go back to ADATs and do, you know? But it was a cool experience, right? And so I think that just drove me more into it. And then there was a period where none of that existed. I finished college, sure as hell couldn't afford a computer, so I was back to the Tascam 244
with a Tandy Realistic.
So actually, like on the non-studio side of my career, right, it went to the non-studio side of my career went to completely on ice, and then I went and joined Amen, right? And then I was in the States, and there was no recording equipment there, so I lived in the States, and I was just playing and performing, like basically going through my first like being in a real rock band situation that was signed in another country, like at a very young age. And that was like a whole weird experience. And obviously went in the studio and did a bunch of stuff out there like a few times.
What studios were you working in?
I can't remember the studio that I was in, but it was with Joe Barisi, which, I mean, Joe Barisi is a fucking legend. And I remember at the time Papa Roach were in another studio recording. And I think actually Joe Barisi was working with Benson. I think him and Benson shared a studio. So I think Joe Barisi had a room at the front of Benson's studio at that time. So it was somewhere in the valley, right, off like Roscoe or something like that, in the valley in LA. But like we were in there mixing, so like I hadn't played on anything. I never got to like record with Barisi. But just to be in the studio with Joe Barisi, right? And at the time, he hadn't quite popped yet. Like, it was almost like he was still, like, making himself, right? And so, yeah, you know, that was, like, a cool thing. But I never really recorded anything out in LA. And then it was after I left Amen and I was kind of in limbo and you just done Shortcut to Newark. I come back and your old engineer, James, basically he was in Vader all the time. I was hanging out with you guys and he had a G4 back at his house. So I was staying at his house a lot and he would go to bed with his missus at like 9 o'clock and I would be sleeping on the couch and he'd be like, if you want to use the computer, just go. So like I'd almost information dumped a lot of like how to use Logic and stuff at the time. Right. And so I'd come back into Vader and I was back in the country and I was like, hanging around when you were doing sessions and seeing and kind of like slowly picking up some stuff again. And it then kind of parlayed into me going to his house and being like, all right, let's figure this out again. So then I'd start drum programming and making some shitty demos with guitars in just the headphones in the box, you know. And actually John Devlin sent me those four demos 2 weeks ago. I forgot they existed. He said, I've got those demos that you made at James's when you started figuring out Logic again. And I was like, fuck. He just sent them to me. And I'm like, I didn't know how to write a song.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because I was a drummer, I'd never really like written songs. And so it was very unrefined. And so I didn't know about arrangements or anything like that. I just kind of made something that I thought sounded cool that had a few different parts. And so that kind of got me back into recording.
Do you think that, I mean, that's something I talk to a lot of people about, the fact that as a songwriter, do you think the DAW is a massive tool now for you to be able to write songs?
It's a game changer. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. It's helped songs and it's ruined songs, right? So I think as I've gotten older, I've learned that I think the best songs are those songs that can be played is a full band and also down to an acoustic guitar. They started on a guitar, right? Like those make the best songs. And to be honest with you, I'm not skilled enough of a guitarist. And like I can sing and play guitar. It's very difficult for me. So a lot of the songs that I actually write are music and then I sing on top of it. And what usually happens with that when it's done in the box like that is it doesn't naturally convert over to doing both things, playing guitar and singing the vocal, because maybe it'll be a bit too wordy or like the rhythm of the vocal like really interferes with the guitar to the point where it's harder for the player, right? So we've done address that with Lee sometimes, like, you know, when I write demos and we do some things, you know, it's because I'm not just playing it, I'm not refined like that, you know, I'm more of a drummer. So that's the negative side of the double-edged sword. I think on the positive side, I think it's empowered a lot more people to write, because like for someone like me, I need that tool, right? Like I need to, you know, I don't go into the box sometimes with a full song, I'll write in the box.
Yeah,
you know,
so I do. Right, when you go along. So what's your rig at home back in Arizona?
So
you've got a little studio, haven't you?
Yeah. So I'm living the dream. We moved into a house that had a 3-car garage. So it was a 2-car garage and then a separate single car garage on the front of the house. And so I basically talked to my homie Bo Bichelle, who put me on to John Sayers Forum.
Right.
I think it's John Sayers Forum of Studio Builders. And then I read through John Sayers Forum, John L. Sayers. I read through his studio forum about everyone will post their studio builds on there and what they're doing. And I was basically just looking for isolation. Like I wasn't really looking to make a great sound of studio and like have it sort of tuned. I just wanted to be able to smash in the neighborhood, in the beat lab and not have the neighbors call the cops on me, right? So that was the A goal. And so I did that. Like I built it. It's basically an isolated room that doesn't touch the walls, like, you know, all the usual principles. It's actually not connected to the floor properly because I have post-tension slab in the garage, so I can't drill into it. So I actually just a load of glue under the fucking 2x4s and glued it to the ground. So it's, you know, it could be moving for all I know. But it gives me pretty good isolation. I can fit a kit in there. You know, it's good enough for two people to work in there at once with like a couple of heads, but you couldn't rehearse in there. So basically what I've got is that's the sort of dimensions of the rooms. It's probably about, I would say it's probably about, 9 to 10 feet wide and probably about 22 feet long. And then because of the way the garage door opens in, it's got like a little chip so that the two doors, like, you know, I've got a Mac Studio that basically I'm running Pro Tools 2022. And then everything, it's all quite rudimentary. Like, I don't have any nice outboard. I have a Focusrite Vocal Master Pro that is, I love it. Stu Richardson from Profits gave that to me, and actually an old guitar pad. Got a funny story about guitar pads, because obviously that's one of my main memories of recording Invader 2 when I first came to record. You just got the kidney pad. It just come out.
Yeah. And that was when people were like, guitar amps are done.
100%. And I remember we did the whole of the first release that I ever did was all kidney pad. You hadn't got the bass pod yet. You couldn't afford it. I remember, because you had that little Mackie 16 track desk. Remember that?
24.
Was it 24?
Mm, okay. 24 into 8.
That's it, yeah. Mm. And so I remember you were like, I've got this new bit of gear and it's fucking amazing. We did everything through the kidney pod. And so I was like, fucking line six, like, that's cutting edge. That's the future.
It was then.
It was. And so I've got an amazing story about line six. I now work with the founder of line six. Right?
Do you?
Marcus Royal. He is one of the most incredible people that I've have in my life at this time, right? He's also mentored me a little bit with some things at work, but he interviewed me. So I work at DW now. I work on a product called DWE. So it's the electronic fully convertible drum kit. So it's a full collector series drum kit with electronic drop-ins that you can have as either or. It's fully wireless. And so, you know, it's kind of a really great dream job. It's a really great product. It's in its infancy. So, you know, we're just kind of like building on it. But Marcus was a consultant on the project. And when I interviewed for the job, I had to interview Marcus. And they were like, we need you to have an interview with Marcus Royal. And he's from Line 6. And I was kind of like, oh, cool. Someone from Line 6 works there. Didn't realize it was the fucking founder. And so, yeah. I interviewed with him. He's awesome. Brilliant mind. Super loves to get in the weeds with the technical details, like even down to like electrical voltages and circuits and stuff. Like, it's just that level of like intellect in regards to that is what made him curate some amazing products. So, basically I ended up interviewing with him. I got to know him over the few years I've worked at DW. And when I was last in Oxnard, we had an in-office meeting and he said, I want everyone to come to my house later for dinner. So we went to his house. And when we were at dinner at his house, he told us how Line 6 started and how the name came around. And I absolutely love it. And I guess the name Line 6 came around because they were working for another company. I don't remember what the company was, but like a group of them worked for this other company. And then they started doing Skunk Works shit in the back room, right? But when the bosses would come around or big dog people come in, they were like, they didn't want them to know that they were working on some products in the back room. So if the phone rang and someone was coming in, the internal receptionist would be like, okay, we got someone coming through on line six. So they would lock up the back room and no one would go in there, right? And so when they broke off and made their own thing, that's how they became line six. And I was like, that is fucking amazing.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So he's a fantastic brain, man. He's like, I'm really honored to have had the opportunity to work with him. He's actually ramped down what he does for the company, but you know, I still talk to him often. But where we got left off, sorry. So yeah, Stuart had given me a line six pod rack. And so there's a bit of me that's attached to it just because that initial recording. I know it's probably not even cool to have a line six.
Do you know what? Pod anymore. There was a few years ago where George Burks was trying to round me up a little bit, and he was going into Centurion and various other, he was in here as well, and he was like looking at all this stuff, like loads of old outboard and stuff that you're just never going to use.
Yeah.
And he goes, dude, what are you doing with all this stuff? I was like, oh, I just keep it. And he goes,
you've got to keep it.
And I was like, why? And he did make me sell a load of it,
yeah,
right? But the one thing I refused to sell, and I've still got it, I think it's down there, is my Line 6 bass pod. And
is it a rack or a kidney?
It's a rack.
Yeah.
And I did loads of the first Enemy album stuff on that. And it's the only piece of gear that I think I've got left from that period of time. So I can't sell it. I will never use it.
This stuff comes in and out, right? The things that you don't believe are going to be a fucking big deal end up becoming a big deal. That's why I feel you can't get rid of
it. Do you think a baseline six?
Don't know. You just don't know. But check this out, right? So I don't have, like, you know, people have their go-to things in the studio or like, you know, like think about Eric Valentine's kick drum. That's an Eric Valentine kick drum, right? There's things that you just know belong to certain people. I never really sought out to curate a like Luke Johnson tone or sound or anything. I just accidentally happened on what, in my opinion, is the greatest bass tone of all time. Every single fucking Low Lies demo, every single Luke Johnson demo has his bass tone on it. And it's actually only achieved with the bass pod and the guitar pod. And the guitar pod is the primary part of it. And Lee, who's Riff Lord tone guy, right? Like sacrilege. He would never, like if I put a brown paper bag over it, right? Like he just, that's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And then like you tell him, it's like, it's a fucking guitar pod and a bass pod. And he's like, what? Right? But it's every, we've tried. And he's like, it's almost like, he's like, no, they're too old school. Like that's not a thing. We can't do that for the bass. And then we go all around the fucking reeking.
And you don't find anything better, yeah.
And then he's like, it's ridiculous.
Use your ears, not your eyes. Yeah, that's exactly what I say to so many bands.
Yeah, and you know. So you got to ask Lee, like, what's up with Luke's guitar pod bass tone? Fucking, it's so grizzly. Mm. It's almost like, you remember Daisy Chainsaw?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not quite as aggressive as Daisy Chainsaw, Love Your Money, but it's
love,
like...
That's a really cool guitar tone. Do you know what? I am actually going to pull out my pods.
I'm glad you said pods. Yeah, thanks for that.
I am going to pull out my guitar pods, and have an experiment with them. So, like, I mean, we've known each other for 25 years.
Yeah.
You've definitely had, it's pushing a sort of a nearly 30-year studio experience, I reckon, if you think about when you first started making demos as a kid.
Yeah, well, I'm 43 now, so, yeah, close to it, 27 years.
Yeah.
Like, you were in my second recording. So I'd, like, you know, I was with you a couple, maybe 3 years after Dave Morris wrapped it up.
I'm only 35.
All right, I'm buying it. I'm buying it.
But no, in that time, I mean, I've known you to record like all over the world in loads and loads of different places.
Yeah.
So in the two extremes, what in your memories are the best studio experiences, and then what was your worst studio experience?
That's a good one. So it's a little bit tough, and you know me, I fucking waffle. I feel like you keep looking at the timer on there just to make sure I'm fine. Like, so shut me up if I'm going off on the deep end. But it's hard to quantify because I've had great studio experiences for other reasons than it being a great recording, right? So like, for example, when we did the last Lost Prophets record, we worked with Ken Andrews, who's fucking awesome. And also the hottest board mixes I've ever heard. Don't think this is a mix, lads. Send you home. And I'm like, this might be the best mix I've ever heard. And this is you not trying.
Yeah.
So that was phenomenal. But working in NRG studios in North Hollywood, that's the first time I'd gone in like a fucking mega baller. Like,
I remember you sending me photos when you were in there and just going, look at this, and all the racks of gear.
Like Linkin Park trying to come in and get in the A room. Can't have it. We're in there. Sorry.
Really?
Yeah. You're going to have to go in the B room. Like, we've booked it out for fucking a month. And it's like fucking $2,000 a day or some shit just for the studio without engineers and everything else, right? So it's like, I'd not been exposed to that and much of that, like, until I was in Prophets, right? I mean, obviously I'd done a ton of recording with Feldman, but his studio was like a baller studio, but it's in a house. It wasn't like an outhouse studio, right? And so, so that was a magic experience for being able to do that and being like being in the studio for a month. Everything I'd always done was always on a time crunch because we haven't got any money.
Mm.
Even Beat Union, when we recorded with Feldman, we did like 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks maybe, but we did 13 tracks of drums in one day. You know what I mean? So it's like,
there's not many drummers I know that are capable of that other than you.
I had to do it because he was like, I want to spend all the time on the vocals. Like, he's like, it was like bass got done in a day, drums got done in a day, guitars got done in like 4 days, 5 days. And then it was like, I just want, like, all I care about is vocals. You put Dave on steroids.
Are you serious?
Dave was getting all emotional. He was like, some days he'd be upset and we're like, what the fuck's wrong with him? None of us knew what steroids did to you. But yeah, he put him on steroids for his voice. Because he would do an hour in the booth and then he'd start being like, huh? And so he got someone to write a script for Dave and got him on steroids, and then he was singing for like 5 hours a day. Fuck him. So, love you, John. So the Ken Andrews stuff was wicked, and I loved working with Ken, but obviously, you know, notoriously working with He Who Shall Not Be Named was very difficult because, you know, working with drug addicts and people who are crazy is very difficult, right? Yeah. And so I'd not really experienced too much of that either, right? Like working with somebody that was mentally unstable and on drugs. So that's what made that not great, right? Because like there was a lot of infighting, like, you know, him and Ken did not get along.
Right.
Whereas the rest of the band and Ken, like, were lockstep, you know?
Yeah.
And we're all massive Failure fans. But then, like, so that had a double-edged sword type of feel to it. I think the first time I went in with Feldman was absolutely mind-blowing because all my recording experience prior to Feldman was with you.
America is so different in studio British massively. Studios.
And so, well, so something that I was going to bring up earlier on, all the early recordings I did with you were no click. I'd never recorded to click, right?
Right.
And so I'd not ever had click in my ear roll until I played in Alec Empire when I didn't do any rehearsals with him. I just got given two CDs, learned them in a rehearsal room, and then we're going to do 2 days rehearsal in Vienna. I went out there with Rich Jones from Amen to Vienna. He didn't show up for 2 days, so we didn't rehearse. So me and Rich Jones just rehearsed together. We had no set list order or anything, just learn these fucking 20 songs. And then on the day of the Donno Festival in Vienna, it was my first show with Alec Empire and Nick Endo. And the sound guy comes up to me. So we were supposed to have a long sound check because we hadn't rehearsed, didn't turn up. Sound engineer walks over to me, hands me a pair of E5s. I said, what are them? He said, they're in ears, you need them for click. And I said, what? I said, I'm fucking click. He said, yeah, mate, you played to click four. I said, no. So I stuffed these fucking things in my ear. I mean, I could play in time. I just never played to a click. But obviously, Nick Endo's running all this fucking Atari Teenage Riot shit through a rig, right? It's fucking going off. So I was like, all right. And I remember just fucking shit falling out my arsehole. I met him and shook his hand and her hand. Both me and Rich Jones met him right as we were walking up the steps of stage. Hey, yeah.
First time. Wow.
And so it's like fucking stepping on stage, headlining this gig, 5,000 people. And it's like, you know, that's still a pretty big gig for me at that time. It's 5,000 people. E5s never monitored through my ears, right? Like fucking always had a big wedge on stage. And yeah, I was like, I fucking survived, obviously, because we carried on the whole tour. And then that was my first exposure to click, and I'd still not recorded to click in the studio. And then when I got with Feldman, actually, I do think I did some click with you in Harpies. We did Shooter McGavin, Shortcut to Newark, First Defense. Mr. Effects and Madman the Greatest.
Yeah.
You got more nerve than a clitoris. Remember that? and then Harpies, right? And then eventually beat Union, and then eventually lost Profits, right? But, you know,
we did a Profit session, didn't we?
We did do a Profit session. And then, obviously, I think in Harpies, I did some click with you. But then, so that was my little bit of click. And then I went over with Feldman. So that session with Feldman was completely foreign to me because I got used to your workflow at the time, which your workflow is probably incredibly different now. I got used to James's workflow and I got used to Dave Morris's workflow. And so that was do whole song takes. So learn your fucking shit before you come in the studio and fucking put it down, right? That was how it was. And so I'm used to doing whole takes. So I go out to record the Beat Union record, with Feldman with this mentality of I've got to be out there sharp, right? And that's the first time that I didn't ever play for any full takes. He was like, I want full energy. He's like, so I'm going to stop you and I'm going to call out Phil's mid. So he kicked everyone out of the studio. He said, so the way Feldman's studio, Foxy Studios was in, not Beverly Hills, Mulholland Drive, right? So it was up there. the top floor was his main room, and he was like a non-desk guy. Like, that was the first time I'd been in a studio where it wasn't a desk, right? So it's top floor. And then there was a control room downstairs, which was on the floor of the control room. So it was almost like the floor one of the house was where the main control room was, but everything was like sub-level down. And so he kicked everyone out of the downstairs. Everything else was done upstairs. So he only tracked drums downstairs. Everyone else went upstairs and they could listen in the main control room, but they couldn't communicate or see me. And then he went round and lit all these coffee candles, which like I smell that smell now. Like, it's an instant smell that takes me back to then, like 2007. Bang, I'm in that studio, right? He got Drum Fetish in. So Gersh and John from Drum Fetish, I got this fucking amazing 1969 Ludwig drum kit that I've recorded several times on. Grohl's used it on Wasting Light with Taylor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a very famous. So Gersh drum techs for Grohl, but he also owns Drum Fetish, which is one of the, like, other than Drum Doctor, it's like those two are the main boys, right? And so he brought in Tama Bell Brass, which is the only fucking snare I swear by in the studio. Like, I can't record unless there's a Bell Brass at the kit, preferably a Tama Bell Brass. And he brought in an Ayotte snare. He brought in Noble Cooley that I've got, the same Noble Cooley. And then this kit. And I remember we actually pitched out the floor tom, and he got a vintage Gretsch floor tom. So it was a mishmash kit. And he was like, right, we're going to do these takes, lit all the candles, turned down the lights, made it such a vibe. And then he was like, let's just go for it. And I'd start the first song and we'd get like through maybe, you know, 30, 40 seconds. And he'd be like, that was fucking epic. And I'd be like, cool, why did we stop? And he'd be like, because I want you to do it again. But when you come in this time, go around the toms on this fill and then finish on that right hand crash back to the hats for four beats and then back onto the right bell. And I'd be like, all right, cool. And so then we'd start playing and he'd be like yelling down the talk back as I was playing. And after I got used to it, after I realized like he was like getting fucking hyped, like he loves recording drums. And it's also in the private cues, the best drum mix that I've ever heard in my life. No one has ever sent back to my in-ears a drum mix through the private cues whilst I'm tracking that sounds like you are the greatest drummer in the world. It's fucking insane. And if I knew what he did, I feel like he maybe compressed the fuck out of it. If I knew exactly what I did, I'd probably try and do that for myself on the daily, you know, makes you feel real good. And so, yeah, it was like wailing down the mic and just, I don't know, we got in this rhythm of vibing and stuff. And then it was 10 beat union tracks. And he's like, right, that's fucking amazing. I want you to do three tracks for a pop artist that I'm working on. Will you drum on the fucking songs? And I was like, sure. So then I'm like learning these new songs on the fly, tracking, for, you know. And so that for me is like always going to have a special place in my heart because it was like, it felt like big time. There was a lot of hype going on. I'd never recorded in that style. Feldman has such a great in-studio etiquette. Like, you know, when people make you feel good in the studio, and I mean, it's good, right? Like I learned about it when I was at Kidderminster College about not to like, right after someone's talk, you know, like leave the talk back off and then like talk in the room, like kind of like make them feel uncomfortable. Like you always want to, because there's that glass window, you know? And yeah, man, I feel like he just pulled the best out of all of us. And he was really, really into the details of that. So that was the first experience, and I've waffled on for ages on this, sorry. So that's probably one of my fondest memories. One of my worst memories in the studio is actually, fuck, I'm just going to go in on this. One of my worst, one of my, not with you, you're good.
Oh. I was like twitching the bum moment.
No,
then.
No. With Profits, we did a session for Fern Cutton Live Lounge, and it was at Maida Vale. And have you ever heard of a fucking Instagram account called Catatonic Use?
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite accounts. Yeah. Well, I made Catatonic Use.
No,
not me personally, but that video, the video from the Live Lounge, mate. So we did. Homeboy was obsessed with anything that wasn't rock music, which is why everything probably sounded so terrible at that time. So he always wanted to collab with everybody that just didn't make sense. So we obviously did songs with Labyrinth, which didn't really make sense for us. But in the studio we did a fucking like cover of like a Jay-Z song, that New York song, Empire State Mind, right? I was about to say Empire State Bastard, great band.
Great band.
So we did that, and the band was tight, I mean, the whole song didn't make sense. It was grimmer. I think everyone was grimming, but he really wanted to do it. And so LMFAO in the studio, and it was just horrific. And it obviously went out on TV and radio. And now Catatonic Youths exists. It fucking ended up on Catatonic Youths. And so I remember the day that I got hit up, like, fucking bro. Because I even before that, I'd always said about Catatonic Youths that, like, no one's safe. Like,
yeah.
A lot of my mates have been on Catatonic Youths, right? I said, no one's safe. And then that day came. But that recording session was horrific.
Yeah.
It was fucking horrific. Yeah.
Oh, mate, it's been so lovely to have you on the podcast. Yeah. And it's been really good to hang out with you because I don't get to see you, man. Same. I miss you loads. And I cannot wait to see you play on Saturday.
I fucking can't wait to have you there, man.
Yeah, it's going to be really good. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be the eighth guest and I'm honored to be on it. I feel you've had an incredible lineup of people and I personally don't feel like I match up to those lineup of people. So for you to give me the opportunity, I'm very grateful. So thank you.
Too humble. Big love to you, matey.
You too, mate.